Right as Rain by George Pelecanos. What Derek Strange was worried about, looking at Jimmy Simmons sitting there, spilling over a chair on the other side of his desk, was that Simmons was going to pick some of Strange's personal shit up off the desktop in front of him and start winging it across the room. Either that, or get to bawling like a damn baby.
"Tell me again, Derek."
Simmons's lip was trembling, and pools of tears were threatening to break from the corners of his bloodshot eyes.
"Tell me again what that motherfucker look like, man."
"It's all in the report."
"I'm going to kill him. And right after that, I'm going to kill his ass again."
"You're talking no sense, Jimmy."
15 years of marriage and my woman's just now decided to go and start taking some other man's dick. You going to tell me now about sense?"
Jimmy Simmons struck his fist to the desktop, next to a plaster football player with a spring-mounted head. The player, a white dude originally whose face Janine's son Lionel had turned dark brown with paint, wore the old gold trousers and burgundy jersey from back in the day, and he carried a football cradled in one arm. The head jiggled, and the redskin toy tilted on its base. Strange reached over, grabbed the player, and ratted it before it could tip over.
"Take it easy. You break that, I can't even charge you for it, because it's priceless, yeah?"
"I'm sorry,
Derek."
A tear sprang loose from Simmons's right eye and ran down one of his plump cheeks.
"Here you go, man."
Strange ripped a Kleenex from the box atop his desk and handed it to Simmons, who dabbed tenderly at his cheek. It was a delicate gesture for a man whose last day under 300 pounds was a faded memory.
"I need to know what the man looked like. I need to know his name."
"It's all in the report,"
Strange repeated, pushing a manila envelope across the desk. Simmons opened the envelope and inched out its contents slowly and warily, the way a child approaches an open casket for the first time. Strange watched Simmons' eyes as they moved across the photographs and the written report. It hadn't taken Strange all that long to get the goods on Denise Simmons. It was a tail and surveillance job, straight up, the simplest, dullest, and most common type of work he did. Simmons rose from his chair, his belly and face quivering as if his flesh were being blown by a sudden gust of wind.
"Well, I'll see you, Derek. I'll take care of your service as soon as I see a bill."
"Janine will get it out to you straight away."
Strange sat in his office, waiting to hear Simmons go out the door. It would take a few minutes, as long as it took Simmons to flirt with Janine and for Janine to get rid of him. Strange heard the door close. He got out from behind his desk and put himself into a mid-length black leather jacket lined with quilt and a thin layer of down. Out in the reception area of the office, Strange stopped at Janine Baker's desk. Behind her, a computer terminal showed one of the Internet's many sites that specialized in personal searches. Janine's brightly colored outfit was set off against her dark, rich skin. She was a pretty, middle-aged woman, liquid-eyed, firm-breasted, wide of hip and lean-legged.
"That was quick."
"He wasn't his usual playful self. He said I was looking lovely today."
"You are?"
Janine blushed.
"But he didn't go beyond that. Didn't seem like his heart was all that in it."
"I just gave him the bad news about his wife. She was getting a little something-something on the side with this young auto parts clerk. Sells the batteries over at the Pep Boys in Northern Virginia."
"This the same guy she was shacking up with 2 years ago?"
"Different guy. Different still from the guy she was running with 3 years before that."
"Why he stay with her?"
"He loves her. I think she loves him, too, so I guess there's no chance for you and Big Jimmy."
"Oh, I can wait."
Strange grinned. "Get that bill out to Simmons, will you?"
"I handed it to him as he was going out the door."
"You always on it."
Strange nodded to one of the two empty desks on either side of the room.
"Where's Ron at?"
"I'm trying to locate that debtor. The hustler took that woman off for $2,000.
"Old lady lives down off Princeton?"
"Uh-huh. Where you headed?"
"Off to see Chris Wilson's mom."
Strange walked toward the front door, his broad, muscled shoulders moving beneath the black leather, gray salted into his hair and closely cropped beard.
You need me, or if Ron needs me, I'll be wearing my beeper.
Strange stepped out into 9th Street, a short commercial strip between Upshaw and Kansas, one spit away from Georgia Avenue. He smiled, thinking of Janine. He had met her the first time at a club 10 years earlier, and he had started hitting it then because both of them wanted him to, and because it was there for him to take. Janine had a son, Lionel, from a previous marriage, and this scared him. Hell, everything about commitment scared him. But being a father to a young man in this world, it scared him more than anything else. Despite his fears, their time together had seemed good for both Strange and Janine, and he had stayed with it, knowing that when it's good, it's rare. And unless there's a strong and immediate reason, you should never give it up. The affair went on steadily for several months. When he lost his office manager, he naturally thought of Janine, as she was out of work, bright, and a born organizer. They agreed that they would break off the relationship when she started working for him. Strange and Janine had recently started things up once again. Their relationship wasn't exclusive, at least not for Strange. And the fact that he was her boss didn't bother either of them in the ethical sense. Their lovemaking simply filled a need, and Strange had grown attached to the boy as well. Friends warned him about shitting on the dining room table, but he was genuinely fond of the woman, and she did make his nature rise after all the years. Strange stood out on the sidewalk for a moment and glanced up at the yellow sign over the door. Strange Investigations. In letters in half of both words enlarged inside the magnifying glass illustration drawn across the light box. He loved that logo. He had built this business by himself and done something positive in the place where he'd come up. The kids in the neighborhood, they saw a black man turn the key on the front door every morning and maybe it registered. Put something in the back of their minds whether they realized it or not. He'd kept the business going for 25 years now, and the bumps in the road had been just that. Strange sat low behind the wheel of his white over black 89 Caprice, listening to a Blackbird's tape coming from the box as he cruised south on Georgia Avenue. Next to him on the bench was a mini Maglite, a Rand McNally street atlas, and a Leatherman tool-in-one in the sheath that he often wore looped through his belt on the side of his hip. He wore a buck knife the same way, all the time when he was on a job. A set of 10x50 binoculars, a cell phone, a voice-activated tape recorder, and extra batteries for his flashlights and camera were in the glove box, secured with a double lock. In the trunk of the car was a file carton containing data in his live cases. Also in the trunk was a steel Craftsman toolbox, housing a heavy Maglite, a Canon AE-1 with a 500mm lens, a pair of Russian-made NVD goggles, a 100-foot steel Craftsman tape measure, a roll of duct tape, and various Craftsman's tools, useful for engine and tire repair. Strange parked in front of Leona Wilson's modest brick home at 12th and Lawrence. Strange saw the curtain move in the bay window of Leona's house. He cut the engine, got out of the car, locked it down, and walked up the concrete path to Leona's front door. The door was already opening as he approached. "Mrs. Wilson," he said, extending his hand.
"Mr. Strange, will you help me?"
They sat beside each other in the living room on the slip-covered sofa, a soft crackling sound coming from the fireplace. Strange drank coffee from a mug. Leona Wilson sipped tea with honey and lemon. She was younger than he was by a few years, but looked older by 10. He remembered seeing her in church before the death of her son, and her appearance since had changed radically. She carried too little weight on her tall, large-boned frame, and a bag of light brown flesh hung pendulous beneath her chin. Strange placed his mug on the low glass table before him.
"I don't know that I can help you, ma'am. The police investigation was as thorough as they come. After all, this was a high-profile case."
"Christopher was good."
Leona Wilson spoke slowly, deliberately. She had been an elementary school teacher in the district public school system for 30 years.
"I'm sure he was."
"The papers say he had a history of brutality. They implied that he was holding a gun on that white man for no good reason when the other police officers came upon them. But I don't believe it."
I have an old friend in the department, Mrs. Wilson. He tells me that Chris was a solid cop and a fine young man.
Do you know that memorial downtown in Northwest? The National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial?
I know it, yes.
There are almost 15,000 names etched on that wall. The police officers in this country who have been killed in the line of duty since they've been keeping records. And do you know that the department has denied my request to have Chris's name put on that wall, Mr. Strange?
I'm aware of it, yes.
The only thing I have now is my son's memory. I want other people to remember him for the way he was, too. The way he really was.
I have no reason to doubt what you say.
So you'll help me?
She leaned forward.
It's not what I do.
I do background checks. I uncover insurance fraud. I confirm or disprove infidelity. I interview witnesses in civil cases for attorneys, and I get paid to be a witness in court. What I don't do is solve murder cases or disprove cases that have already been made by the police. I'm not in that business.
The white policeman who killed my son? Did anyone think to bring up his record the way they brought up my son's record?
Well, if I recall, I mean if you remember, there was quite a bit written about that police officer. How he hadn't qualified on the shooting range for over 2 years, despite the fact that they require those cops to qualify every 6 months. How he was brought into the force during that hiring binge in the late 80s, with all those other unqualified applicants. How he had a brutality complaint sheet of his own. No disrespect intended, but I think they left few stones unturned with regard to that young man's past.
In the end, they blamed it on his gun.
They did talk about the negatives of that particular weapon, yes. The Glock has a light trigger pull and no external safety.
I want you to go deeper. Find out more about the policeman who shot my son. I'm convinced that he is the key.
Mrs. Wilson.
Christopher was proud to be a police officer. He would have died without question. He did die without question in the line of duty. But the papers made it out to seem as if he was somehow at fault, that he was holding his gun on an innocent man, that he failed to identify himself as a police officer when that white policeman came up on him. They mentioned the alcohol in his blood. Christopher was not a drunk, Mr. Strange.
Nor an angel, thought Strange. He'd never known any cop, any man, in fact, to be as pure as she was making him out to be. Yes, ma'am. He watched Leona Wilson's hand shake with the first stages of Parkinson's, as she raised her teacup to her lips. He thought of his mother in the home, and he rose from the couch. He looked at the photographs framed on the mantel. He saw Leona as a young woman and the boy Christopher standing under her touch, and another photograph of Leona and her husband, whom Strange knew to be deceased. There were a few more photographs of Christopher, in a cap and gown and uniform, and kneeling on a football field with his teammates, Christopher's gaze hard, his eyes unsmiling and staring directly into the camera's lens. A high school boy, already wearing the face of a cop. There was one photo of a girl in her early teens, its color paled out from age. Strange knew that Chris Wilson had had a sister. He had seen her on the TV news, a pretty, bone-skinny, light-skinned girl with an unhealthy, splotch complexion. Strange thought it over, his back to Leona. It would be an easy job, re-interviewing the players, retracing steps. He had a business to maintain. He wasn't in any position to be turning down jobs. My rates.
Sir?
He turned to face her. You haven't asked me about my rates.
I'm sure they're reasonable.
I get $30 an hour plus expenses. Something like this will take time.
I have money. There was a settlement, as you know. And Christopher's insurance, his death benefits, I mean, and his pension. I'm certain he would have liked me to use the money for this.
Strange went back to the couch. Leona Wilson stood and rubbed the palm of one hand over the bent fingers of the other. "I'll need access to some of his things," said Strange.
"Well, you can have a look in his room."
"He lived here?"
"Yes."
"What about your daughter?"
"My daughter doesn't live here anymore."
"Can I reach her?"
"I haven't seen Sandra or talked with her since the day I buried my son."
"I'll help you, Mrs. Wilson. Do what I can."
Leona Wilson straightened her posture and brushed a strand of gray hair behind her ear.
"Will you be in church this Sunday?"
"I'll try real hard."
"I'll say a prayer for you, Mr. Strange."
He picked his leather up off the back of the chair. "I'd surely appreciate it if you would."
Leona's posture had changed when he told her he'd take the job. It wasn't his imagination, either. The years had seemed to drop off her before his eyes. He'd been straight up with Leona Wilson back at her house, as much as anyone could be with a woman that determined. Her temporary hope was a fair trade-off for the permanent crash of disappointment that would surely follow later on. Anyway, he needed the money. The Chris Wilson case was a potential $1,000-$2,000 job. Strange drove down to the MLK Library on 9th Street and went up to the Washingtonian room on the third floor. He retrieved a couple of microfiche spools from a steel drawer where the newspaper morgue material was chronologically arranged. He threaded the film and scanned newspaper articles on a lighted screen, occasionally dropping change into a slot to make photostatic copies when he found what he thought he might need. After an hour and a half, he turned off the machine, his eyes had begun to burn, and when he left the library, the city had turned to night. Outside MLK, Strange phoned Janine's voicemail and left a message. He needed a current address on a man. He gave her the subject's name. Strange went up to his office, a converted bedroom next to his own bedroom on the second floor, and read the newspaper material, a series in the Washington Post and a Washington City paper story that he had copied from the library. As he looked them over, his dog, a tan boxer named Greco, slept with his snout resting on the toe of Strange's boot. The case for Ennio Morricone, a fistful of film music, was sitting on his desk. He removed disk one from the case and loaded it into the CPU of his computer. The first few strains of Per Qualche Dollario MPU drifted through the room. He turned the volume up just a hair on his Yamaha speakers, sat back in his reclining chair with his hands folded across his middle, closed his eyes, and smiled. Strange loved westerns. He'd loved them since he was a kid. He locked the front door of his shop, checked it, then walked up Bonifant Street toward Georgia Avenue, turning up the collar of his black leather to shield his neck from the chill. He passed the gun shop, where black kids from over the district line and suburban white kids who wanted to be street hung out on Saturday afternoons, feeling the weight of the automatics in their hands and checking the action on guns they could buy on the black market later that night. He passed an African and a Thai restaurant, and Vinyl Link, the music store that still sold records, and a jewelry and watch repair shop that catered to Spanish, and one each of the many braid and nail and dry cleaning storefronts that low-rise the downtown business district of Silver Spring. He crossed the street before reaching the Quarry House, one of two or three neighborhood bars he frequented. About now, he could taste his first beer, his mouth nearly salivating at the thought of it, and he wondered if this was what it felt like to have a problem with drink. He cut through the bank parking lot, passing the new Irish bar on the second floor of the corner building at Thayer in Georgia, and he did not slow his pace. He neared a black man coming in the opposite direction, and though either one of them could have stepped aside, neither of them did, and they bumped each other's shoulder and kept walking without an apology or a threatening word. On the east side of Georgia, he passed Rosita's, where a young woman named Juana worked, and he was careful to hurry along and not look through the plate glass, colored with Christmas lights and sexy neon signs advertising Tecate and other brands of beer, because he did not want to stop yet. He wanted to walk. He dropped 35 cents into the slot of a payphone and dialed Rosita's, and his friend Rafael, who owned the restaurant, answered.
"Eh, amigo, it's... I know who it is. Not too many gringos call this time of night, and you have that, voice of yours that people recognize very easily. And I know who you want."
"She working?"
"Yes."
"Is there a C next to her name on the schedule?"
"Yes, she is closing tonight." "Are you outside? I can hear the cars."
"I'm taking a walk."
Go, or you'll walk. And I'll put one on ice for you, my friend. I'll see you in a little bit.
He hung the receiver in its cradle and crossed the street to the pedestrian bridge that spanned Georgia Avenue. He looked north on Georgia at the street lamps haloed in the cold, and watched his breath blow out into the night. He had grown up in this city. It was his. And to him, it was beautiful. Sometime later, he crossed the remainder of the bridge and went to the chain-link fence that had been erected in the past year. The fence prevented pedestrians from walking into the area of the train station via the bridge. He glanced around idly and climbed the fence, dropping down over its other side. Then he was in, near the small commuter train station, a squat brick structure with boarded windows housing bench seats and a ticket office, and he went down a dark set of stairs behind the station. He entered a fluorescent-lit foot tunnel that ran beneath the Metro and B&O railroad tracks. The tunnel smelled of nicotine, urine, and beer puke, but there was no one in it now, and he went through to the other side. He walked along the fence bordering the old Canada Dry bottling plant, turned, stood with his hands buried in his jeans, and watched as the Red Line train approached from the city. He looked across the tracks at the ticket office as the passing train raised wind and dust. He closed his eyes. He thought of his favorite Western movie, Once Upon a Time in the West. Three gunmen are waiting on the platform of an empty train station as the opening credits roll. Eventually, the train arrives. A character named Harmonica steps off it and stands before the men who have come to kill him. Their shadows are elongated by the dropping sun. The ensuing violent act is swift and final. Standing there at night on the platform of the train station in Silver Spring, he often felt like he was waiting for that train. In many ways, he felt he'd been waiting all his life. After a while, he went back the way he had come and headed for Rosita's. He was ready for a beer, and also to talk to Juana. He had been curious about her for some time. Juana Burkett was standing at the service end of the bar, waiting on a Marg Rocks No Salt from Enrique the bartender, when the white man in the black leather jacket came through the door. She watched him walk across the dining room, navigating the tables, a man of medium height with a flat stomach and wavy brown hair nearly touching his shoulders. He seated himself at the short, straight bar and did not look at her at first, though she knew that she was the reason he was here. She had met him briefly at his place of employment, a used book and vinyl store in Bonifant, where she had been looking for a copy of Home is the Sailor, and Raphael had told her that he had been asking for her since, and that he would be stopping by. On the day she had met him, she felt she'd seen him before, and the feeling passed through her again. Enrique placed the margarita on her drink tray, and she dressed it with a lime wheel and a swizzle stick, and walked it to her foretop by the front window. Raphael was standing beside the man in the black leather jacket, and the two of them were shaking hands. She heard Raphael call her name, and she walked around the bar to where he stood and the man sat, his ringless hand touching a cold bottle of beer.
"You remember this guy?" said Raphael.
"Sure," she said, and then Raphael moved away. Just left her like that. Went to a deuce along the wall to greet his two occupants.
"So," the man said in a slow, gravelly way, "did you find your Jorge Armando?"
"I did find it, thank you. We got Teresa Batista in last week. It's in that paper series Avon put out a few years back."
"I've read it,"
she said too abruptly. She was nervous in showing it. It wasn't like her to react this way in front of a man.
"Juana, right?"
He leaned forward and cocked his head. He was moving very quickly, and it crossed her mind that what she had taken for confidence in his walk might have been conceit.
"I don't remember telling you my name the day we met. Raphael told me. And now you're going to tell me that you like the way it sounds. That my name sings, right?"
"It does sing. But that's not what I was going to say."
"What then?"
"I was going to ask if you liked oysters."
"Yes, I like them."
"Would you like to have some with me down at Crisfield's after you get off?"
"Just like that? I don't even know."
"Look here."
He put his right hand up, palm out.
"I've been thinking about you on and off since the day you walked into the bookstore. Now,
I believe in being to the point, so let me ask you again. Would you like to step out with me after your shift and have a bite to eat?
They stared at each other for a while, not speaking, as the recorded mariachi music danced through the dining room and bar.
What I was trying to tell you before you interrupted me is that I don't even know your name.
It's Terry Quinn, he said.
Terry Quinn, she said, trying it out. Irish Catholic, if you're keeping score.
And Juana said,
It sings. Where's your car?
Asked Juana.
You better drive tonight, said Quinn. I'm in the lot. We should cut through here.
They went through the break in the buildings between Rosita's and the pawn shop. They neared Fred Folsom's sculpted bronze bust of Norman Lane, the mayor of Silver Spring, mounted in the center of the breezeway.
God, it's cold!
Juana held the lapels of her coat together and closed to her chest and looked over at Quinn.
I've seen you before, you know? And not at the bookstore, either.
I was in the news last year. On the television and in the papers, too.
Maybe that's it.
It probably is.
There's my car. That old Beetle? What, it's not good enough for you?
No, I like it.
What do you drive?
I'm between cars right now.
Is that like being between jobs?
Just like it.
You ask me out and you don't have a car?
So it's your nickel for the gas. Quinn zipped his jacket.
I'll get the oysters and the beers.
They were at the bar at Crisfield's, and they were eating oysters and sides of coleslaw and washing it down with Heineken beer.
Said Juana,
swallowing a mouthful, reaching into the cracker bowl for a chaser. A dozen raw and a plate of slaw.
These are good, right? They're good.
All the stools at the U-shaped bar were occupied, and the dining room to the right was filled. The atmosphere was no atmosphere. White tile walls with photographs of local celebrities framed and mounted above the tiles, wood tables topped with paper placemats, grocery store bought salad dressing displayed on a bracketed shelf, and still the place was packed nearly every night, despite the fact that management was giving nothing away.
Make any money tonight? Said Quinn. By the time I tipped out the bartender, not real money, no. I walked with 45. You keep having $45 nights, you're not going to be able to make it through school. My student loan's putting me through school. I wait tables just to live. Raphael tell you I was going to law school?
He told me everything he knew about you, but don't worry, it wasn't much. Pass me that Tabasco, will you? He touched her hand as she handed him the bottle. Her hand was warm, and he liked the way her fingers were tapered, feminine and strong.
Thanks.
A couple of black guys seated on the opposite end of the U, early 30s if Quinn had to guess, were staring freely at him and Juana. Plenty of heads had turned when they'd entered the restaurant, some he figured just to get a look at Juana. Most of the people had only looked over briefly. But these two couldn't give it up. Well, fuck it, he thought. If this was going to keep working in any kind of way, and he was getting the feeling already that he wanted it to, then he'd just have to shake off those kinds of stares.
That's not fair, said Juana. What is it? You've been asking about me, and you know some things, but I don't know a damn thing about you.
That accent of yours, he said.
What accent?
Your voice falls and rises like music.
What is that, Brooklyn?
The Bronx. She shook an oyster off her fork and let it sit in the cocktail sauce. He turned to face her. Her hair was black, curly, and very long, and it broke on thin shoulders and rose again at the upcurve of her smallish breasts. She had a nice ass on her, too. He had checked it out back at the restaurant when she'd bent over to serve her drinks. Her eyes were near black, many shades deeper than her brown skin, and her lips were full and painted in a dark color with an even darker outline. He was staring at her now, and she was staring at him. And then her lips turned up on one side, kind of a half-smile that she attempted to hold down. Quinn chuckled under his breath.
What?
Nothing.
It's just that thing you got going on, your almost smile.
I just like it, is all. Juana retrieved her oyster from the cocktail sauce, chewed and swallowed it, and had a swig of cold beer.
How do you know Raphael?
He came in the shop one day, looking for Stanley Clark's School Days on vinyl. Raphael likes that jazz funk sound, the semi-orchestral stuff from the 70s. I call him when we buy those old records from time to time.
You always work in the bookstore?
No, not always. What you want to know is, am I educated, and if so, why haven't I done anything with it? I went to the University of Maryland and got my criminology degree. Then I was a cop in D.C. for 8 years or so. After I left the force, I thought I was ready for something quiet. I like books, mostly westerns. She studied his face.
I know where I seen you now.
Right. I'm the cop that killed the other cop last year.
It's the hair that changed.
Uh-huh. I grew it out. Quinn waited, but the usual follow-up questions didn't come. He watched Juana use her elbow to push the platter of oyster shells away from her. While he watched her, he drank off an inch of his beer.
How about me?
Asked Juana.
Anything else you want to know?
Not really. What I know so far I like.
Not a thing, huh?
Can't think of anything off the top of my head right now.
Let me go ahead and get it out of the way then, all right? My mother was Puerto Rican and my father was black. I'm comfortable in a few different worlds and sometimes I'm not comfortable in any of them.
I didn't ask you that.
You didn't ask me that yet.
What I mean is, I don't care.
You don't care tonight. Tonight there's only attraction and do we connect. But this world we got out here, and the people in it right now, they're not going to let us not care.
Like those two guys over there have been staring at us all night.
How about we deal with it as we go along?
On their way out the door, Juana noticed Quinn glance over his shoulder at the two men who had been staring at them all night, and give them both a short but meaningful look. Ray Boone's jaw was tight from the thick line of crank he'd done. He unglued his tongue from the roof of his mouth and licked his dry lips. Ray went behind the long mahogany bar he and his daddy had built themselves, looking to fix himself a drink.
Daddy! Where that jack at?
Ray couldn't hear his own voice above the old Randy Travis number that was coming from the Wurlitzer jukebox he'd borrowed at an auction at the furnishings from a bankrupt restaurant. Edna had turned up the volume way high. Earl Boone was sitting in front of a video screen playing electronic poker. He took a sip from a can of Busch beer and dragged on his cigarette.
Wherever the hell you left it, critter? Last time you took a drink.
Oh, I see it.
The jack was on the low shelf beside the steel sink, in front of a Colt automatic his daddy had hung on a couple of nails he'd driven into the wood behind the bar. Ray grabbed the black-labeled bottle and a tumbler, filled the glass with ice from a chest behind the sink, and Freeport sour mash whiskey halfway to the lip. He filled the rest of the glass with Coke and stirred the cocktail with a dirty finger.
Ain't you gonna fix me one, baby?
Asked Edna Loomis, sitting at a card table covered in green felt. Edna was speed-wired, her usual condition this time of the afternoon.
Don't want you getting wasted too early now.
I won't. Just want a little something to sip while I'm back at the house watching my shows.
Ray mixed a weak one and walked it over to Edna, who stood to take it from his hand. She reached for the glass, running her long fingers over the backs of his, and clumsily licked her lips.
We got time,
she said, looking over his shoulder briefly at the old man.
Me and Daddy are about to make a run into D.C.
When you get back, then,
she said, tossing a head of damaged orange blonde hair off her shoulder, winking as she took a sip off her drink. Ray looked her over. Boy, she thought she was so sexy. She was getting up around 30, and it was showing in the lines around her mouth. Dimples had begun to pucker below her ass, too, and she never had young eyes. She did have a nice set, though, the kind that stood at attention with sharp pink button nips. She ever let those bad boys go to see like the rest of her was doing, Ray'd have to think about trading her in for a new model.
Huh? I asked you a question, critter. We gonna make like bunny rabbits and do the deed when you get back or what?
Her mouth. That was the other thing. Brow, titties, and nose. She didn't learn to shut her mouth some. You might trade her in sooner than she knew.
Don't call me critter. Only daddy can call me that. Well, are we?
Maybe. But she'd be sloppy as hell by the time he came back from the city. Cooked on crank and drunk as a sailor on shore leave, too. He couldn't stand the fucker when she got like that.
Ray? Huh? You gonna be gone a few hours, right? Uh-huh. Why don't you leave me some of that ice? You know you liking that stuff too much. Please, baby.
A little bit then. He looked past her and said,
You about ready, Daddy?
Yep.
Ray went to a large door at the back of the barn. The door was steel fortified, and it was set in a fortified fireproof wall. He took the set of keys he hung from the loop of his jeans and opened the door, which he kept locked at all times. On one side of the room sat a weight bench and barbells and plates, with mirrors angled toward the weight bench and hung on the walls. A workbench ran along the opposite wall with shelves above it and a pegboard with hooks holding tools. A couple of safes sat beneath the workbench, and in the safes were money, heroin, and guns. Beside the workbench stood a footlocker next to a stand-up case made of varnished oak and glass, in which four shotguns were racked. On the third wall was a single-unit kitchenette with a two-burner electric stove, sink, and refrigerator stocked with bottled water and beer. Ray used the stove to make his private stash of methamphetamine, both the powder and the crystal, which he cooked on the stove in a small saucepan. On the steel countertop of the kitchenette were bottles of Sudafed and carburetor cleaner, and other chemicals he used to make the crank. Ray and his father had plumbed in some pipes and put a bathroom in the room, too. It was big and private, with a solid oak door. Beneath the carpet remnant that lay beside the weight bench was a trap door. Under that trap door was a tunnel that he and his father had dug out the summer before last. The tunnel was their means of escape, in the event that one was needed, and it went back about 50-60 yards or so, into the woods behind the barn and the house. Ray Boone loved this room. Only he and his daddy were allowed back here. That was the rule. Nobody, none of daddy's friends or his own friends or Edna, would think of coming back here, even if they had access to the key. Ray picked up a set of barbells and stood before one of the mirrors. He did a set of 20 alternating curls. He dropped the barbells and checked himself out. His prison tats showed just below the sleeves of his white t-shirt. A dagger with blood dripping from it on one arm, a cobra wrapped around the stab of a Confederate flag on the other. Standard issue stuff. The good tattoos, a swastika between two lightning bolts and a colored guy swinging from a tree, he kept covered up on his shoulder and back. Ray made a couple of serious faces in the mirror, raised his eyebrows, first one, and then the other. He wasn't too good-looking, so anyone would mistake him for a pretty boy, but he wasn't all that ugly either. Some women liked the way his eyes were set, real deep under his hard, protruding brow. A couple of times when he was growing up, some boys called him cross-eyed, and he just had to go ahead and pop those boys hard, square in the face. If he was cross-eyed, he didn't see it himself. When Ray was done admiring himself, he grabbed a vial holding a couple of meth crystals and slipped it into the pocket of his jeans. He took off his sneakers and put on a pair of dingo boots with 4-inch custom heels, opened the safe, and removed a day pack holding plastic packets of heroin the size of bricks that he had scaled out earlier in the day. He found his 9mm Beretta, checked the load, and holstered the automatic in the waistband of his jeans. From the footlocker, he withdrew a heavy flannel shirt and jacket and put them both on, the tail of the shirt worn out to cover the gun. He slung the day pack over his shoulder, left the room, and locked the door behind him. Edna was waiting for him out in the bar. She gave him a wet kiss as he palmed the vial over to her, then left the barn with her drink in her hand.
Ready, Daddy? Sure thing.
Ray and Earl's property was set back off Roof 28, between Dickerson and Comus, not too far south of Frederick, at the east-central edge of Montgomery County. There was still forest and open country out here, but not for long. Over the years, the Boones had seen the development stretch farther and farther north from D.C., white flighters mostly who claimed they wanted more land and more house for the buck. What they really wanted, Ray knew, was to get away from the niggers and the crime. Ray moved the car onto the on-ramp of 270 and drove south.
Here,
said Ray, handing his pistol butt out to his father. Earl took the gun, opened the glove box, hit a button and waited for the false back to drop. He placed the Beretta in the space behind the glove box wall. Ray had bought this particular vehicle from a trap car shop up in the Bronx. The bumper was a false bumper, which meant it could withstand a medium velocity impact, and could also accommodate relatively large volumes of heroin between its outer shell and the trunk of the car. Hidden compartments behind the glove box, to the left of the steering column, and in other spots throughout the interior concealed Ray's guns and his personal stash of drugs. Ray lit a cigarette off the dash lighter, passed the lighter to his daddy so he could light his.
"You know we was the bad guys," said Ray, "if this here was a movie."
"Why is that?"
"Could you and me smoke?"
"Huh."
"Down county? I hear they want to outlaw smoking in bars."
"That's so."
"They can have mine. When they pry him from my cold dead fingers, right?"
Harold didn't answer. He didn't talk much to begin with, and he talked even less with his son. Ray had been absent the day God passed out brains, and when he did say something, it tended to be about how tough he was or how smart he was. Earl had 20 years on Ray, and Earl could take Ray on his weakest day. Ray knew it, too. Earl figured this was just another thing that had kept the chip on his boy's shoulder his entire life. Earl popped the top on a can of Bush. Ray dragged on his cigarette. It bothered him that his father barely gave him the time of day. It was him, Ray, who had set up this business they had going on right here. It was him, Ray, who had made all the right decisions. Of course, it took a stretch in Hagerstown where Ray had done a 10-year jolt on a manslaughter beef for him to find the opportunity to connect to this gig he had there. Ray had been paid to kill some K-head who ripped off the stash of a dealer out in Frederick County. This particular job, Ray's idea had been to do it in the bathroom of a bar where the K-head hung out, then climb out the window and make his escape. After he gutted the thief with a K-bar knife, though, the bar's bouncer came in to take a leak and disarmed Ray, holding him until the pigs could get to the scene. What he did do, he claimed the dust bunny had attacked him, and lucky for Ray, a piece of shit 22 was found in the jacket pocket of the corpse, so the hard rap couldn't stick and Ray drew manslaughter in Hagerstown. Prison life was okay if you could avoid getting punked. The way to avoid it some was strong attitude, but mostly alliances and gangs. The whites hooked up with Christian Identity and the like. The blacks hung together, and so did the Spanish. But the whites and Spanish hated the blacks more than they hated each other. So once in a while, Ray made talk with a brown or two. One of them was Roberto Mantilla. Roberto had a cousin in the Orlando area, Nestor Rodriguez, who worked for the Vargas cartel operating out of the Coca Valley in northern Colombia. Nestor and his brother Lizardo made the East Coast run, selling powder to dealers in D.C., Baltimore, Wilmington, Philly, and New York. Pure heroin at a lower cost had expanded their market, crushed their foreign competition, and fueled the growth of their business. Roberto said that his cousins could no longer handle the logistics of the transitions themselves and would be willing to sell to a middleman who could make the back and forth into D.C. and satisfy the demands of the dealers more readily than they. For this, said Roberto, the middlemen would receive a $10,000 bounce per transaction. Ray supposed he had Roberto Mantilla to thank for his success, but this was impossible, as Roberto had been raped and bludgeoned to death by a cock diesel with a lead pipe shortly after Ray's release.
"This load we got, it's 85% pure, Daddy,"
said Ray, thinking of the heroin sealed in the bumper compartment of the rear of the car.
"Lizardo tell you that?"
asked Earl, needling his son, knowing Ray hated the Rodriguez brother who had never showed Ray any ounce of respect.
"Nestor told me, down in Florida. They got brown heroin. It's 95% pure when it hits the streets."
"So, what's that do?"
"For the Colombians, it kills the competition. I'm talking about the Asians who were putting out 7-10% product, and the Mexicans too. The Colombians upped the purity and lowered the price. Now they're going to own most of the U.S. market. And what this pure shit does, it creates a whole new class of customers. College kids, the boy next door, like that."
"That's nice."
"You not interested in what we doing?"
"No, not really. Wasn't for the money, I'd just as soon never set eyes on the city again. Let them all kill themselves over this shit."
"You wouldn't want that. Wouldn't have no customers, they all end up and died."
"Greater?"
"Well,
someday you and me, we gonna wake up and figure out we got enough money. You ever think about that?"
"I'm starting to."
Truth be told, Ray had been thinking on it for quite some time. Only piece missing was a way to get out. By the time Earl had killed another beer, Ray had gotten off the beltway and was on New Hampshire Avenue heading south into D.C. Later, on North Capitol, down near Florida Avenue, he made a call on his cell phone and told Cherokee Coleman's boys that he and his father were on their way in. Ray passed by Cherokee Coleman's place of business, one of several small brick row houses in the complex, indistinguishable from the rest. Coleman's place was across the street from what folks in the area called the junkyard, a crumbling warehouse where crack fiends, blow addicts, and heroin users had been squatting for the past year or so. Ray drove slowly down the block. Coleman's army, steerers, pitchers, money handlers, lookouts, and managers, was spread out on the sidewalk and on several corners of the street. A cop car approached from the other direction. Ray did not look at his uniformed driver, but rather at the large numbers printed on the side of the cruiser, a Crown Vic, as it passed.
"Ray?"
"It's all right," said Ray,
matching the numbers on the car to the numbers he had memorized. In the rear view, Ray saw the MPD cruiser make a right at the next corner, circling the block. Ray punched the gas and made it quickly to the bay door at the garage and on the end of the block. He honked his horn, two shorts and a long. The bay door rose and Ray drove through, into a garage where several young men and a couple of very young men waited. The door closed behind them. Ray got his gun out of the glove box trap and pushed his hips forward so that he could holster the 9mm beneath the waistband of his jeans. He knew his father had slipped his .38 into his jacket pocket back in the barn. He didn't care if the young men in the garage saw the guns. He wanted them to see. Ray and Earl got out of the car. There was no greeting from Coleman's men, no nod of recognition. Ray knew from his prison days not to smile or show any other gesture of humanity, because it would be seen as a weakness, an opening, a place to stick the knife.
"Money, clothes, cars!"
rapped a dead, even voice from a small stereo set up on the shelf.
"Clarkin' G's! Getting skeezed!"
"It's behind the bumper,"
said Ray to the oldest of the bunch, whom he'd seen on the last run.
"Didn't get it, chief,"
said the young man, the manager, with a slow tilt of his head.
"You get it," said Ray.
Ray stared them down, and they stared him down, and a couple of the older ones laughed, and Ray laughed some. And then there were more hard stares. And then the manager said,
"Get it,"
to one of the younger ones, who nodded to the guy next to him. Those two dismantled the bumper and got the heroin packs out of the space. Coleman's employees scaled the heroin out quickly, on an electronic unit that sat on a bench along a wall, while Ray and Earl smoked cigarettes. They did not taste it or test it, not because they trusted these two, but because Coleman had instructed them to leave it alone. Coleman knew that Ray and Earl would never try and take him off.
"The way's good." "I know it's good. Call Cherokee and tell him I'm coming in. We'll be back for our car."
The group began chuckling as the Boons walked from the garage, after one young man started singing banjo notes. Ray didn't care. All of them would be croaked or in the joint soon anyway. It felt good walking out of there, not even looking over his shoulder. Like he didn't give a good fuck if they laughed themselves silly or took another breath. Ray and Earl stepped quickly down the block. The cold wind blew newspaper pages across the street. Ray met eyes with the young man talking on the cell, knowing that the young man was speaking to one of Cherokee Coleman's lieutenants. They kept walking toward Coleman's place, and when they neared it, a door opened, and they stepped inside. They were in the outer office then, and four young men were waiting for them there. One of them frisked Ray and Earl and took the guns that he found. Ray allowed it because there was no danger here. If something was to have gone down, it would have gone down back in the garage. Coleman didn't keep drugs, handle large amounts of money, or have people killed anywhere near his office. The one who had frisked them nodded, and they went into Coleman's office. Cherokee Coleman was seated in the leather recliner behind a desk. The desk held a blotter, a gold pen and pencil set, and one of those lamps with a green shade, the kind they used to have in banks. A cell phone sat neatly next to the lamp. Coleman wore a three-button black suit with a charcoal turtleneck beneath the jacket. His skin was smooth and reddish-brown against the black of the suit, and his features were small and angular. He wasn't a big man, but the backs of his thick-wristed hands were heavily veined, indicating to Earl that Coleman had strength. Behind Coleman, leaning against the frame of a small barred window, was a tall, fat, bald man wearing shades with gold stems. He was Coleman's top lieutenant, Angelo Lincoln, a man everyone down here called Big Ass Angelo.
"Fellas,"
said Coleman, lazily moving one of his manicured hands to indicate they'd take a seat before his desk. Ray and Earl sat in chairs set lower than Coleman's.
"How's it going, Ray? Earl?"
"I do," said Earl.
"How do... what?"
Angelo's shoulders jiggled and a sh-sh-sh sound came from his mouth.
"Looks like everything checked out all right," said Coleman.
"No doubt," said Ray. "The weight's there, and this load is honest to God high test, 85 per."
"I heard."
Coleman didn't feel the need to tell Ray this purity percentage stuff was straight up bullshit. If the shit was 85-90% pure for real, you'd have junkies falling out dead all over the city. Cause shit that pure was do it on the head of a matchstick stuff only.
"You hear it from the Rodriguez brothers?"
"Yeah. They called me to discuss some other business."
"This business involved my father and me?"
"It could."
Coleman turned to his lieutenant.
"Looks like we got a killer batch on our hands, Angelo."
Earl shifted in his chair. The room was warm and smelled of oils or perfume. Some shit like that. Color guys with their paper evergreen trees hanging from the rearview mirrors and their scented crowns and their fancy fucking smells.
"About the Rodriguez brothers," said Ray.
"Nestor," said Coleman.
"Now he's gone and added cocaine to that sales bag of his. I had to explain to him I'm getting out of that business. Low fiends and pipeheads, their money's green too, don't get me wrong, but all the cash is in brown powder right now, and that's where I see the money of the future too. So the cocaine I do buy, I buy from the Crips out of L.A. Thing I'm trying to say is, I don't want to be beholden to just one supplier. Gives them too much power with regards to the price structure and negotiation side of things, you know what I'm saying?
Beholden to with regards to price structure and negotiation side of thing? Christ," thought Earl. "Who the fuck does this nigga think he is?" "What did Nestor say to that?"
"He implied that it might imperil our business relationship. I don't buy all my inventory from him, and I don't like those kinds of words. Almost sounds like a threat, you understand what I'm talking about?"
"I'm hip. I'm with you."
"Oh, you hipper than the motherfucker," thought Coleman. "And of course you're with me. Where the fuck else would you be if it wasn't for me?"
"We done?" said Earl.
"You in a hurry?" said Coleman with a smile. "Got a lady waiting?"
"What if I do?"
Coleman's smile turned down. His voice was soft, almost tender.
"Oh, shit, Earl, that little red bone don't mean nothing to me no more. I done had that pussy when it was fresh. You go on, sweet talk your little junkie all you want here."
"I guess that'll do her,"
said Ray. He stood and looked at his father, who was still seated in the chair, one eyebrow cocked, his gaze on Coleman.
"Go ahead, Earl," said Coleman. "She's waiting on you, man. Got that stall of hers all reserved. Guess she heard you was coming into the big city today."
Earl stood. "Now, Ray, think about what I said about that Rodriguez thing. No disrespect to my brown brothers, but maybe you ought to talk to them next time they drop off the goods. Tell them straight up the way I feel."
"I hear you."
"Good. Your money will be waiting for you back in the garage. You can pick up your guns on the way out."
"See you next time,"
said Ray, and he turned for the door.
"Hey, Ray. Lazardo Rodriguez, he asked me to check and see if you were wearing those fly boots of yours today."
"Oh, yeah?"
"I see you are."
Ray's expression was confusion. He said,
"Later."
And he and his father walked out of the room, closing the door behind them. Coleman and Big Ass Angelo laughed. They laughed so hard that Coleman had to brace himself atop the desk. He had tears in his eyes, and he and Angelo gave each other skin.
"Oh, shit! Ray Boone walking tall! Just like Buford T. Pusser, man."
"I am hip,"
said Angelo. And Coleman doubled over, stomping his foot on the floor.
"I got him to thinking, though, anyway, about the Rodriguez boys, I mean."
"We lose the Rodriguez boys,
we find someone else to buy from, Black.
Got a price and purity war going on in the business right now. It's one of those buyer's markets you hear about.
That means we wouldn't be seeing Rand Earl no more. Shame to lose all that entertainment. I mean, who we gonna laugh at then?
Find someone else for that too. Angie.
What?
Crack that window, man. Smells like nicotine beer and electric shave in this motherfucker.
I heard that.
Every time the boons come in here, it reminds me. I just can't stand the way white boys smell.
Ray and Earl picked up their guns in the outer office, lit smokes outside of Coleman's building, and walked across the street. They went through a rip in the chain-linked fence that surrounded the old warehouse. They stepped carefully through debris, mindful of needles, and over a pile of bricks that had been the foundation of a wall but was now an opening. And then they were on the main floor of the warehouse, puddled with water leaked from pipes and rainwater, fresh from a recent storm which came freely through the walls. A rat scurried into a dim side room, and Ray saw a withered black face recede into the darkness. The face belonged to a junkie named Tonio Morris. He was one of the many bottom-of-the-food-chain junkies near death and too weak to cut out a space of their own on the second floor. Later, when the packets were delivered to those with cash, they'd trade anything they had, anything they'd stolen that day, or any orifice in their bodies for some rock or powder. They went up an exposed set of stairs. At the top of the stairs, they walked into a landing on the second floor. They went through a hall, passing candlelit rooms, housing vague human shapes sprawled atop mattresses. Then they were in a kind of bathroom without walls that Ray guessed had once been men and women's restrooms, but was now one large room of shit-stained urinals and stalls. Ray and Earl breathed through their mouths to avoid the stench of excrement and vomit that overflowed the backed-up toilets and lay pooled on the floor. In the doorless stalls were people smelling of perspiration and urine and wearing filthy, ill-fitting clothes. These people smiled at the boons and greeted them, some caustically, some sarcastically, and some with genuine fondness and relief. They kept walking, and at the last stall they stopped.
Give me some privacy, Crater. I'll meet you back at the stairs.
Ray nodded and watched his father enter the stall. Ray turned and walked back the way he'd come.
Hello, young lady, said Earl, stepping into the stall and admiring the damaged, pretty thing before him.
Hello, Earl.
She was a tall girl with splotch-light skin and straightened black hair that curled at its ends. Her eyes were tinted green, their lashes lined, the lids shadowed. She smiled at Earl. Her teeth carried a grayish film. She wore a dirty white blouse, halfway open to expose a lacy bra, frayed in several spots and loose across her bony chest. Votive candles were lit in the stall, and a model's photograph ripped from a Vanity Fair magazine was taped above the commode.
Got something for me, Earl?
Earl looked her over. God damn if she wasn't a beautiful piece underneath all that grime. Nothing like this one had ever showed him any kind of attention, not even when he was a strapping young man.
You know I do, honey pie.
Earl produced a small wax packet of brown heroin that he had cut from the supply. She snatched the packet from his hand, making sure to smile playfully as she did.
Thank you, lover,
she said, tearing at the top of the packet and dumping its contents into a glass paperweight she'd kept balanced atop a rusted toilet roll dispenser. She tracked it out with a razor blade and did a thick line at once, and almost at once her head dropped slightly and her lids fluttered and stayed halfway raised.
Careful not to take too much now.
When she was done, Earl gently pushed down on her shoulders, and she dropped to her knees on the wet tiles. He unzipped his fly because she was slow to do it and wrapped his fingers through the hair on the back of her head. When he felt the wetness of her mouth and tongue, he put one hand on the steel of the stall and closed his eyes. Ray checked his wristwatch. 15 minutes had passed and still his old man had not showed. Ray was ready to leave this place, the junkyard and the city and the trash who lived in it. It disgusted him, thinking of what his daddy was doing back there with that high yellow girl. She did have white features, but she was mud like the rest of them. You could believe that. His father and him, they disagreed on a few things, but none more than this. What was Earl thinking, anyway? Once, Ray had made the mistake of calling that girl common nigger trash, and his father had risen up, told him to call her by her name.
Hell, he could barely remember her name. It was Sandy Williams, something like that.
Ray Boone flipped open the top of his box and shook another smoke from the deck.
Sandra Wilson, that was it.